Okay, today is September 13th,
yep.
2022, and this is Karen Brewster, once again with Ed Zappel.
Yeah.
Okay, I said it right this time.
Well, Zappel, really, Zappel. But...
Zappel.
I answer to a lot of things.
I'm sure you've had to, your whole life, pronounce it for everybody. And we're at Rasmussen Library on the UAF campus in Fairbanks, Alaska. And Ed has thought of a few more things he wants to tell me about when he grew up here in Fairbanks and what things were going on in the 1930s or so, right?
Right. Okay. You ready to start?
Yep, go for it.
Well, the first thing, if you never heard of a man named Moose John.
I have not.
Okay. Moose John kept chickens so you could get fresh eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't too tasty because Moose John fed them dried salmon.
Oh.
You can imagine what those eggs tasted like.
A little fishy?
Well, I there were fresh eggs all right, but good grief. There was also, on Cushman Street, on the east side of Cushman Street, between Front and Second Avenue, halfway through that block was a hardware store. And there was a power pole right there at the sidewalk up by the street. And every loose sled dog in town would go by down there, and they'd leave their smell to see who else had been there and leave their signature there. And, of course, that in the wintertime, that was perfectly fine and dandy. But wait till spring came. And that hardware store owner figured, I'm going to have to put an end to this. So he went out, and then he put a thin copper sheet around that power pole,
oh.
And he wired it back to a Ford spark coil inside the front window of the hardware store. And those dogs would come down, smell great, lift the leg, and they never came back again. After that, they all crossed the street on the other side of Cushman Street to go to the bridge. They avoided that pole like poison.
Because it zapped them when they peed on it?
Oh, of course. Have you ever seen a Ford spark coil?
No.
Well, you know, they used to have magnetos on them before we had distributors and stuff. And you can get one hell of a jolt. I don't know. Amperage is not so much, uh-huh. But that's... That really gets it.
Well, that would work.
Oh, well, yeah, especially for those dogs. No.
Now, was that Ford, that hardware store? You talked about Ford's hardware?
Well, I don't know who owned it. Okay. I don't remember. But it was a spark coil was Ford.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, because it was really something. No, Mrs. Ford.
Yes, Mrs. Ford. Okay.
She was a little old lady who's been up here for years and years and years, maybe one of the very first. She was well-educated, a little tiny woman, and she was kind of eccentric. Of course, everybody here was, one way or the other. And she married a fairly well-to-do miner. He lived a couple of years after the marriage, and then he died. And, of course, he had a house and other stuff here in the town. And a few years later, she married another miner. He lived a couple of years, and he died. I think she married about three of them, and she wound up with property all over town. All over town.
Wow.
Well, after the last one died, she was getting a little bit long in the tooth and so on. And so she figured that she wasn't going to find any more rich miners. So she would wear shoe packs,
mm-hmm.
overalls and clothes, and a hat on her head, and didn't bathe very often. And so Grandpa would not let her eat at the counter.
Oh.
He had a little table set up back by the oven. And that's where she had to come for her coffee and donut or whatever. Because he wouldn't let her out on the rest of the place.
Because she smelled?
Well, I don't think we noticed that so much, but she just wasn't very, well, she was rather, let's say, unkempt.
Yes.
Anyway, the city decided that they were going to put a sidewalk on 3rd Avenue behind a building that she had there with cement sidewalk. She asked for the price. They told her, and she, of course, wasn't about to pay that price. So she went out and said, hey, if I do it, if I build it, will you accept it? And the city said, sure, but I'm going to have to inspect it as you go along. So she went out there. She dug it out, put gravel in there underneath, formed it up, and she poured that cement sidewalk by herself. And the city bought it and figured it was okay.
Wow.
Well, after that, one day, they were going to call a jury. So they called these potential jurors in, and on the list was Mrs. Ford. Well, when they impaneled the jury, these guys said, well, I'm not going to sit on that jury, not if Mrs. Ford is there, because they all knew who she was. And the judge said, you will, or I'm going to put you in jail, because that's your civic duty. Well, comes the day that everybody's going to get sitting, and they call these names, and here comes these men. Yeah, and of course, they're all spruced up. They've taken a bath sitting there. And no Mrs. Ford. What happened to Mrs. Ford? Why isn't she here? And at the last minute, more or less, in comes a little lady dressed in 1890s and 1900 finery, high button shoes, all those dresses and everything like Mrs. Ford.
Wow.
She'd gone to... She'd probably taken two or three baths in one of the bathhouses and dressed up in the best she had and came in there. And she sat on that jury. And when it was all over, the jurors and the judge were impressed. She was very articulate, and she knew what she was doing. And as soon as the trial was over and she was dismissed, she went back with her shoe packs, her overalls, just like she had always been. And in her buildings that were all around the town, there was no lights in there, no power at all, and you never knew where she would be sleeping. There was a warehouse, I think it was probably on 2nd Avenue, about out past Noble or something like that, and a friend of mine and I sneaked in there one day when we knew she wasn't going to be there, just to see what was there. And she had mattresses in there, regular big mattresses. And there was about like maybe six of them in a stack.
Wow.
And what she'd do is she'd get under about three of those mattresses on top of the others and just lay there. And that's how she slept. She had enough insulation at the top of her and underneath her where she was nice and warm, no matter how cold it got. Because she never had heat in any of her buildings.
Wow.
But she survived. When it's 60 below, she was just great. She also had, maybe you've seen them, the old pocket watches.
Mm-hmm.
When you had to wind them up with
a key.
With a key.
Mm-hmm.
And she had some of them. She had a whole lot of those artifacts in there. I only hope that when she died, that the city or the state was able to go in and collect some of those artifacts. Because they dated way back to the first days of Alaska.
Who knows? In those old buildings?
I would hope so.
Did she have a first... Do you know what her first name would have been?
I have the faintest idea, it must be in the record someplace.
She was always Mrs. Ford.
Yeah, Mrs. Ford. And she was a character.
Yeah, well, she was practical, wearing shoe packs and overalls.
Shoe packs with a couple of three pairs of socks and overalls. And... I'm sure she had long johns on.
Sure. That was a much warmer, more practical way to go than those dresses.
Oh, hell. You know, never survive with the dresses. Never.
What did your mom wear?
Well, she wore pants. I don't think that my grandfather wanted her to wear pants, but she wore pants.
Yeah.
All the time that I was up there.
Right. And your grandmother?
Well, my grandmother came back... Well, when we were down south in the States, She wore dresses.
Yeah, well, but up here.
Up here, she was only here a few months.
She
fell and broke her hip, and of course that was it.
Yeah, we'd have to look in those old photos to see.
Yeah. Now, I want to tell you something about the Zabel background.
Okay.
You know, Grandpa Frisch came in search of a better life.
Mm-hmm.
The Zabels did not. They came from a place over in Germany that the place that they came from probably was a place called Zabel, the city. And that city is known even today for making ceramic type stuff, like power insulators and things of that sort.
Oh, okay.
So they use kilns and so on. And the Zabel family over there was fairly well to do. They had two sons that went to Heidelberg University. And they were in the university in 1948.
Oh.
Now, if you recall history, 1948, there was a rebellion led by the students at Heidelberg University. And two of the Zabel boys, not my direct ancestor, but two of the Zabel boys were officers in that rebellious army.
Hmm.
When Otto von Bismarck put down that revolution, he was searching for all those officers, and of course every time he caught one of them, off went their head. My direct ancestor, Frederick, he was born in 1834, and at 17 years old, in 1851, he was on the boat headed for the Americas. So he just, I believe he just barely escaped getting his head cut off.
Yeah, you said the rebellion in 1948. You meant 1848.
1848. Yeah, 18. Okay. Heaven's sake, 19.
I was confused. Yeah. 1948.
Yeah,
that doesn't match with Bismarck,
yeah.
But okay.
1848. Yeah, it was 1848 and 1851.
Okay.
He was on that boat because he had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And on that boat was a man by the name of Christoph Jentz and his family. I have no idea whether they were associated with this rebellion or not. But they were there, and they had a daughter named Frederica, the female version,
right,
you know, of Frederick. And Frederick and Frederica got married, and they went to Chicago. Now, uh-huh. Chicago had a long time before that a fire.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was built, like most of those cities in those days, a frame. And the old legend, you maybe have heard it, about Mrs. O'Leary
and her cow
kicking.
Yep.
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, but something happened in Chicago, and a lot of those frame buildings burned down. And so Chicago, after that, concentrated on building brick buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to have brick kilns. So the Zabel family, because they knew how to use kilns and make brick, they became brickmakers in Chicago, and they owned several brickyards.
Mm-hmm.
And all of their boys worked in the brickyards.
Mm.
Now, my father's father was one of several boys. They all worked in the brickyard. My father worked in the brickyard when he was growing young, after his father died. Now, I told you his father died in 1906. His father was John William Zabel, and he died in 1906 of esophageal cancer.
Oh.
As a well-to-do German burger, he undoubtedly smoked cigars.
Yeah.
And that's probably what did it to him.
Or working in the brickyard.
What's
that? All the dust from the brickyard?
Well, he might have, but I don't think that would have gotten cancer.
I don't know.
That cigar certainly didn't help.
Right, so he was, John William Zabel was your grandfather.
That's correct.
Okay, but you never knew him.
And he had two sons, John August, and my father, who was Edwin John. He had two daughters, an Elsie, and she was the oldest one. And he had another daughter, Wilhelmina. And Willie married a man by the name of Robert Koprasch.
Okay.
And Robert Koprasch was one of the inventors of the Super Heterodyne radio. And he went to New York as part of the RCA, Radio Corporation of America. Mm-hmm. That was the Koprasch. And when I was on a business trip down to visit Pratt & Whitney down in Florida, Miami, West Palm Beach is where they were at, I went to see them at West Palm Beach, and I called Willie Koprasch and just said hello. Now, of course, she didn't live in West Palm Beach. Oh, no, she lived in Palm Beach.
Oh.
Well, you know, that's the wealthy side.
Okay.
So that's where she was, but I never went to see her.
Okay.
So that's about the size of that.
So you didn't really know much, you didn't interact much with that side of the family.
No, not really. Robert Koprasch had two sons, and they're back in New York City someplace. Mm-hmm. So that's about all I really...
About your uncle?
Oh, Uncle John?
Yeah.
Well, he and my father both had rheumatic fever when they were little, and he died at 54.
Oh,
so
that's right. He had a heart issue. Right.
He had a heart attack just like my father
did.
That's right. Now, he had one son, Johnny, and Johnny was my age, and he was in the Occupation Army of Japan after the war.
Mm.
He had three daughters, Betty, Priscilla, we called her Puss, and another daughter, Mary Darlene. Darlene it was. Their mother's name was Marion, and I think Marion might have been French. How he met a French woman, I have no idea. But anyway, she outlived him, of course.
Right.
And she lived with, I think she lived with Priscilla for a number of years, and she died not too awfully long ago,
wow.
Really.
Wow.
So she lived a long time.
Yeah.
But Betty married a man named Zajac of some kind. And Priscilla and her husband live up in Brainerd, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a wolf
as
a pet dog.
Yep. Well, they have those hybrid wolf dogs.
Well, yeah, they make a very good guard dog, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When we were looking at the photographs yesterday in the archives from your mother, or maybe it was when we were looking at the yearbook, you mentioned that you and a friend made some explosives in the chemistry...
Of what?
You made some explosives in the chemistry lab. Would you like to
yes,
tell that story?
Yes, we did. If you take glycerin and take nitric acid... And you have to cool that stuff, and you mix it, that makes nitroglycerin. You have to have something else with it as well. And it's a kind of an oily liquid. And nitroglycerin is exactly the explosive element in dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very touchy. So Chester D. Long and I in the chemistry lab up on the third floor of the school building, we tried this, we made some. We thought we had it, but it started to heat up a little bit. He and I figured we'd better get that stuff the hell out of this building.
Yeah.
So I carried the crucible, one of the regular porcelain crucible. Mm-hmm. I carried it in my hand, and he opened the doors. We went down the steps, out the back door, and there was snow on the ground, and we carefully poured it out on the snow. What else were we going to do with it?
And why did you decide to make it? Just to see?
Well, just to see if we could. Same way we made thermite.
What's thermite?
Thermite is iron oxide and aluminum powder, and you can't get it to start. You have to start it with something, and you use a little thin strip of magnesium foil, and you put it into that mixture, and light the magnesium. Now, you can do that with a match. And when it burns in there, it sets that iron oxide and aluminum together, and the iron oxide deoxidizes and goes to the aluminum. So then you had aluminum oxide, but now you've got molten iron. It's about 3,000 degrees, you know, and it'll go right through anything. If you put it right here, there'll be a hole in the table.
Wow.
Just right now. And we made some of that. Now the question is, what are you going to do with it?
Exactly.
Well, we took it outside.
Same thing.
The only thing you could do with it.
So did you light it?
Yes, which of course we did.
Yeah, and what did it do?
Well, we put it out there on the side, snow, and lit that magnesium strip, and shoom, it went right down through that snow and into the ground.
Wow.
Didn't hurt anything.
No,
but
that's good.
But that's the kind of thing that we did.
Well, and you were allowed to just do whatever you wanted in science class?
I don't think that we, Willie Walton, even knew we were doing that.
I was going to say, where was the teacher?
He was the teacher. He was the one, wherever my hat is.
Uh-huh.
Well, Mr. Walton, he let Chester and I do what, you know, study. We were his star students, you know, and we were just doing whatever we could. But we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we must have had an Alaskan brain.
What does that mean?
It means that you're intuitive and you want to find out things. You want to learn.
Uh-huh.
All the time. You want to learn. And we did.
Well, and it's funny. It was Mr. The teacher was William.
William. We called him Wee Willie Walton.
Yeah, that was.
But his name was William Walton. And his picture was in that yearbook.
Right, but it's funny you called him Wee Willie.
Well, we didn't dare call him Wee Willie.
No.
But that in discussing him.
Yes.
And we used to say he's Wee Willie Walton from Walla Walla, Washington.
But
he was our scoutmaster. And I told you about that swimming hole.
Right.
He was a scoutmaster, and there all us boys were. But he was a good guy. He was a really good guy. And consider, like we were talking about, a little class of 15 people, 15
right.
men. He inspired several of us.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Boy Scouts. We didn't talk about that yesterday.
What's that?
About the Boy Scouts.
Well, he was a troop leader, scoutmaster, and Howard Miskovich was in it, and Howard Shields. And myself, of course, and several others. I'm sure that Jim Hutchinson was in there as well. Just a whole group of about that same age. And we used to go out here and there and so on. And they had a scout camp out at Harding Lake,
mm-hmm.
which I spent one spring out there getting it ready for the troop to use during the summer. Because you know, during the winter, you got it all shut up.
Right.
So anyway, we were pretty active. And, of course, when my legs went bad with this osteo, that kind of put a quietus to that thing. It was just, you know, I just wasn't very able.
Yeah. So how old were you when you were in Boy Scouts?
Well, I was 12 years old when we got up here in 35, so I went right into the Scouts
okay.
right away. When I could survive Mrs. Miller with her 18-inch ruler.
Oh, you're the teacher.
I know.
Right? Yeah, you were saying that it was the same teacher that taught your mom, right?
Exactly the same. And you saw that Palmer Method thing.
Her handwriting.
And my mother could, just a gorgeous, you know, script. Spencerian script is beautiful.
Yeah, well, there was a picture, too. The menu on the wall for the coffee shop was in that script.
Mm-hmm.
So she must have done the menu.
Yeah, that's possible.
It's
but
beautiful.
I couldn't do Spencerian script if I died. Just no way.
Yeah.
Well, you saw my printing and so.
Well, but yeah, it's a very, it's almost like calligraphy.
Yeah.
That yeah. fancy script.
Well, I think that my mother could do calligraphy.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a pity that I can't do it, I can tell you.
Well, it's an art form.
Yeah, I know it's an art form, yeah. and I'm not an artist.
Yeah, me neither. Me neither. So, did you, with the Boy Scouts, did you guys go out hiking and camping? And
no, we didn't go hunting, but we would camp.
Yeah.
And of course, some of us, like me, we'd go out and camp all, maybe one or two of us at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go out hunting, of course, and not very smart, I'd go by myself.
Right.
And around here, you don't want to do that, and especially up in the hills.
Right.
Ed and I were talking about that, and I said, well, if we go hunting, I'm not going to worry because you can run faster than I can, and the bear's going to get me.
Right. Well, how did you get out to the hills?
Well, we walked.
You walked?
Of course. Well, you know, Birch Hill's only about 5 miles away.
Yeah.
And we used to walk out there. Now, on a Birch Hill, and Ed and I drove out there this morning, there used to be a man by the name of Tony Raddick, and his little farm was along the base of Birch Hill, on the south side of Birch Hill, around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Toggenburg goats.
Oh.
He had his cabin was on the hillside of that road, and his goat barn was on the low side. And every time that I would go out there or anything like that, I'd stop by Tony Roddick, and he would give me a glass of his goat milk. Mm. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
And up where the cemetery is now on Birch Hill was a hay field. And we used to go up there, and that's where I tried to ski with those skis with just a loop over.
Yeah.
And you can't control those damn things at all. I tried to ski on that thing and almost killed myself. I found in an old boiler in Fairbanks here an old, old 30-06 from World War I.
Wow.
That somebody had stuffed in this old boiler and it was just forgotten. It was all frosted up with ice in it and everything like that. I found it in there. I said, oh my goodness. I took it home, took it all apart, bolt and everything, cleaned it all up, put it back together again, and I kept it for a rifle. Now, it had the base for the battle sights, you know, that you put on top, and it had a bar like that you slid it on, and you could wreck the sight up, and you could raise the thing up. Well, that part was gone. The base for it was there, and it had the knife sight on the front, like the battle gun sight had. I was afraid to shoot it.
Mm.
Well, heck, I was only about 14, and I knew it was going to kick like a mule. So I took that whole thing out to Birch Hill. I got on the backside of a birch tree, put the gun on the front side of the birch tree, held it up against that birch tree, and fired one of those .06 rounds, and it made an awful gash in that old birch tree. And I was very happy that birch tree was there instead of my shoulder.
Yeah.
I never fired that gun until I was already out of high school when I fired it in a normal way.
Wow.
But I hunted, of course, but not with that one.
No. Well, that was smart to use the tree.
What's that?
That was smart to use the tree.
Well, heavens, yes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that would I'd had an awful bruise.
Yeah.
I kept that thing until I was drafted into the Army, and then I sold it. I wish I had kept it.
Yeah.
Because that was a good gun. Since that time, my wife's father was a member of the NRA, and he was able to get surplus .06s.
Oh, okay.
Well, he got an old sniper gun. It was the Lee Enfield variety. It had a long barrel on it. It was accurate as all get out. And he sold it to me. I had a scope sight put on that thing, and I used that for hunting as a grown man.
Right.
And it was very accurate, and I gave that gun to one of my grandsons, and he says, that's marvelous. And he used it for hunting coyotes and antelope over in Montana.
Uh-huh.
And he says, if you shoot it, it's right where you aimed it, it's there.
Good.
It was a very good gun. And it was better than the Springfield version, because the Springfield version, the barrel's shorter. And so you didn't have quite as much control on it. But that was a good weapon, excellent weapon.
You mentioned that skiing, trying to go skiing. Did you ever do cross-country skiing?
Oh, cross-country skiing? Yes, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And snowshoeing.
Uh-huh.
And when my boys were up here logging, and down south, there was a lot of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, I'll get you some snowshoes. So I went and ordered out of back east,
mm-hmm.
and ordered trail shoes, not bear paws.
Right.
Trail shoes. And some of the kids asked me, why are you getting those? I said, have you ever tried to walk in a pair of bear paw snowshoes? If you do, you won't be able to sit down very well. Because, you know,
you have to keep your feet so far apart?
Well, heavens, yes, those are great big, you know, big round things
right.
like this. And you've got two of those, you trip over your own feet.
Yeah.
But trail shoes are not. And so I got a pair of trail shoes. And my boys used them all the while where they were logging.
Because
mm-hmm. some of the places they were logging, it was like 6 feet of snow. And they
right.
had to have something like that. And David said he had them up in one place down in the, out of Ellensburg,
uh-huh.
up high. And he had them and walked back to where they were working. And when he got done out there, one of the other guys had to go back to where the trucks were, and he wanted to borrow the shoes. And David said, no way. There's nobody uses those shoes but me. And he had them until he got killed.
Uh-huh.
And John had a pair of them, and he used them. He may still be using them.
Right. When you were a kid around here, did you use the birch, made out of birch with moose hide?
What's that?
What kind of snowshoes did you use growing
Trail
up?
Shoes. Trail shoes. I never did try to get anywhere with a bear paw.
Right.
I tried them once, and that was once enough.
And where did you get your snowshoes as a kid?
That's a good question. I really don't remember where we got them.
Okay.
We maybe got them from the Indians.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
They probably were. Because,
yeah.
you know, the Indian shoes, had babish.
Mm-hmm.
And these modern ones got leather or something
right.
else. And the leather kinds of get wet, and it really doesn't work well. The babish works very well.
And were they heavy?
What?
Were the shoes heavy to walk with?
No, not really.
Okay.
Not really. Of course, you know, when you're snowshoeing, you don't go like this. You kind of go easy.
Right.
But if you pick them up and down like that, that's a lot of work.
Right. You kind of shuffle.
Well, with trail shoes, not so bad, because, you know, they're only about that wide.
Right, yeah.
But those bear paws, yeah. something else.
Yeah. So, speaking of the Indians, when you were growing up, were there native people in Fairbanks?
Well, there were some. There were some. There was a kind of a derogatory term. There was one, we called him a squaw man, because he had an Indian wife, and they lived out... They lived out about 4 or 5 miles out on the Richardson Highway. And there were some Indian people here in town. We didn't have that much problem with the alcoholism at that time. Because after all, remember, this was a dry town.
Right.
So, and of course, we didn't have much drugs. You know, I don't remember ever seeing any drug problem here in Fairbanks. We had problems with alcohol, but not drugs. Now, of course, it's an entirely different world.
Right, right. So did the native people and the non-native people interact with each other?
Well, I don't know. We had native people in school,
uh-huh.
native boys,
mm-hmm.
and some of them lived out on the farmer's loop, and heck, they were friends of mine.
Yeah.
So I don't think we had any problem with them. Now, some of the stores may have had a problem because there were people that had prejudice here. And like I was telling you the other day, we had those colored men
mm-hmm.
with a colored laundry lady. They were nice. They were friends.
Right.
You know, it's a different environment. It's different now.
Right. Yeah.
But it was different. And I am sure that if you're out someplace and there's either a native person or one of those colored gentlemen that's got a problem, you're going to help them. Because mm-hmm. they would certainly help you.
Right.
Not anymore.
No.
Not unless you get way out in the tule weeds.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering, was what the sense of community was like, what Fairbanks was like with the people.
Well, we had some people that were problems.
Mm-hmm.
That's like my mother didn't get along with Eva McGowan.
Right.
And she grew up with her. So there were problems. Anytime you get people together, you're going to have clashes
yes.
of personality.
Right.
And so I'm sure that there was some of that, but it really wasn't very vicious.
Right.
It's not like it is now.
No. Well, that's good to know. Just trying to get a sense of what Fairbanks was like back then.
Well, quite frankly, from a cultural standpoint, it was a nice place to grow up in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Not so now, but we got along pretty well with everybody.
Yeah. See? It was a simpler time. Right?
Yeah.
Well,
it was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, the war just raised hell with things.
Yeah.
It changed cultures all over the world.
Yep.
All over the world.
Yeah. Speaking of what it was like to live here, you've been talking about getting food, hunting, and the fresh eggs. What did you guys do? Was there a grocery store? How did you get food?
Well, the NC Company was about the only grocery store that we had. And on the between 1st and 2nd Avenue, halfway between Cushman and Lacey, there's an alley that goes from 2nd to 1st.
Mm-hmm.
And on the east side of that alley, a grocery, not a grocery store, but I guess it was a grocery store, came in there. And I have no idea who it was, but there was there. That's the first real grocery store we had here other than the NC Company.
Mm-hmm.
And the NC Company had everything. I mean, after they had traps and clothes and groceries of all kinds. But the only other grocery store was that one.
And you don't remember the name of that one?
I really don't remember. But it must be in the archives someplace.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And did you get fresh fruits and vegetables?
Fresh fruits and vegetables? Not really. We got dried apples and dried apricots and that sort of thing. Fresh ones? No. Apples? No. Oranges? No. None of that. And, of course, avocados and stuff, out of the question. Cherries? No. But we did have blueberries, high bush cranberries, low bush cranberries, a lot of low bush out in the muskeg.
Right, so you would go berry picking.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course, we're awful careful when we're out picking blueberries.
Because there's some four-legged furry things?
You better believe it.
Yep. We all carry bear spray nowadays.
You're going out here, and you're picking on one side here, and you raise up and look, and you got something picking on the other side?
I know. I'm always afraid of that when I'm out picking. I keep looking up. You wouldn't hear them coming.
Well, no. They're awful quiet.
They are. For such big things, they're pretty quiet. But and your grandfather had a garden. Your grandfather grew the delphinium. Did he grow vegetables?
No, he did not. And in 1979, I took my boys out here all the way up, drove up with a camper on the back of our truck. And we came out here to the university. And there was a beautiful garden up here.
Yes.
It was up here on the hill.
Uh-huh.
And I looked in that garden, and I swear I saw a watermelon in there.
I don't know.
Well, it certainly looked like it. Maybe it may have been a green pumpkin or something.
Yeah.
But it was about that big round, and it was a gourd of some kind.
Yeah, they grow squash and things.
Okay, maybe it was a squash. But it was a beautiful garden up here.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's all buildings.
Right.
And Ed and I are going to go down to the botanical
garden.
Yeah,
that I was going to say. Go to the botanical garden.
We are.
Good.
Yeah.
But so nobody in your family grew vegetables? Your mother, your father?
No. Well, my father wasn't a farmer
no.
at all.
Right.
And they, he was too busy down there with a bar and one thing and another, and so was my mother.
Oh, right.
So we didn't grow anything. We had a nice big lot there at 7th and Barnett.
Right.
Plenty of room, but we didn't grow any at all. And Grandpa didn't grow any. And Frank Saunders, Josie's husband,
right.
he tended the flowers there at the house. But that was all just flowers.
Right.
And everything else came in from outside.
So you got all that from NC Company.
Yeah. Now, we did get potatoes.
Okay.
There was a lot of potatoes grown out here on the farmer's loop.
Uh-huh.
And if you bought your potatoes from a farmer who was growing them up on the hillside, they were good potatoes. If you bought them from somebody who was growing them down in the muskeg, hey, they're beautiful potatoes. But when you boil them up to make mashed potatoes, you wound up with potato soup.
Yeah, they were mushy.
Well, it had so much water in them, and you had soup.
Yeah. Well,
well, I know, but then that's not the same.
It's not the same as mashed potatoes.
You know, you can't eat them with a fork.
No. You had mentioned about walking to school and walking downtown.
Well, yeah.
Was it dirt roads and boardwalk, or was there sidewalks?
Well, it was all wooden boardwalks.
Okay.
There was really very little concrete here.
Right.
Very little.
Even in the 30s.
Hmm?
Even when you were here growing up, as late as the 1930s.
Well, yeah, the late 30s, after 35 to 41.
Right.
And, yeah.
But still boardwalk.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Matter of fact, that's what I used to use getting downtown during the spring flood.
Right.
With boardwalks.
Wouldn't the boardwalks flood?
Well, they'd lift up off the ground.
Oh, okay.
You know, they weren't really anchored down. They'd just lift up
and
just take it. Piece of boardwalk, got a raft already
made.
Oh,
I see. That's funny. There's something else I was going to ask you. Kramer's Dairy.
Oh, yes.
Or was it Hinckley's then?
What's that?
Was it the Hinckley family that still
owned
it?
The Bentleys had the other dairy. Bentley.
I don't know that one.
And, well, there's a road out there that talks about Bentley's out in that area.
Oh, yeah, I know the where the Walmart and all that stuff is.
Yeah, Fred Myers is out in
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Bentley's Dairy, he had jerseys. And my mother used to get milk for us kids from Bentley's Dairy, not from Kramer's. Kramer's had Holstein's. And, of course, there's quite a difference in the butterfat content between Jerseys and Holsteins.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yes, there is. So, it's a big difference.
So which is better?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Bentley's, the Jersey milk is much better.
It has more butterfat?
Much more. Hmm. You know, Holsteins usually are less than about 2% butterfat. Jerseys are up to like 4%.
Oh.
And of course, goats, much more than that. So we always used Bentleys. And of course, Bentleys, my mother knew the Bentleys from a long ways back.
Uh-huh.
Well, and the Kramers really didn't have much of a dairy in here when she was a little girl. And I don't know how long Bentleys or when Bentleys came, but they were here a long time.
And did they have other things besides milk? Like ice cream or butter?
You know, I don't think I had any ice cream when we were growing up. There was no creamery in here to make it like
that.
And, of course, we get milk in Chicago and set the bottle out on the step, and the cream would rise, and you get about that much cream.
4 inches
in a bottle of milk.
Right.
And, of course, the folks used that for their coffee.
Right.
We didn't get any, but
they
used it. And you could take Bentley's milk and let it set where it would cool. And, yes, you'd get a nice head of cream on it.
Wow.
and used for the coffee.
Right. Well, when we were looking in the archives yesterday, there was a newspaper article about your mother coming up here to visit.
Yes.
And it said, in fact, she was not the first white girl.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. It apparently was a couple of days or something like that. But we always thought that she was the first white girl born here.
Yeah, it said the other girl, it was like 2 days. She was born
a couple of days earlier.
And I think her last name was Hinckley.
Yes, Hinckley.
Hinckley, which was the first owners of Kramer's.
They owned
the dairy before, yeah.
Okay, so Kramer's bought Hinckley's out.
Oh, yeah, I think, or they married a daughter or something like that, yeah.
Well, Kramer's dairy, I used to walk along the side, walking out toward the university, because the road went right alongside the dairy, and they had a great big pea field on alongside the road. And there's nothing that tastes any better than to go in there and get a couple of those nice green fresh peas off those pea vines and eat them right there along the road. They're wonderful.
So you'd pick as you walked along?
Oh, yeah, walking along the road. You know, everywhere we went, we walked.
Right.
In the summertime. And in the wintertime, you had to walk because all the cars were up on blocks.
Right.
And, of course, in the wintertime, there certainly weren't any pea vines.
No, not at all. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, I know there used to be a sawmill.
There was a sawmill. It was over by the river, upstream from town.
Right.
And that's where Mrs. Ferguson's husband worked, at the sawmill. And that's where Grandpa got his scantlings to fire up his oven.
And what is scantlings? It's just like the...
Well, no. If you take a log, and the first thing they do with it is they'll run it through the saw, and it cuts off a slab.
The bark part.
Well, yeah.
The
so you've got this
part.
Slab with bark, right. And that gives you a flat surface that you use as a reference point. All right. Now, that slab wood is generally about, in the old days, it was about maybe 2 inches thick. And we used to use the whole slab in fires. Well, nowadays, and even then, in order to try and get as much lumber as you could out of that thing, they take that slab wood now that's like this and cut like that, and they cut the corners off of it and see if they can't get a one-by out of it.
Oh, right, okay.
And those corners are what we used to call scantlings.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't know that term.
Yeah.
I thought it was like those bark pieces that they cut off to make the flat surface.
No. The slabs are the ones that make them flat. Right. Of course, once you got a flat surface, now you can set that on the saw table and cut all the rest of it up. So you wind up with every log, you'll wind up with 4 slabs, and then you cut them in as much as you could to get out of them.
It makes sense. You get as much as you can.
What's that?
Makes sense to get as much as you can.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what did you use to heat your house? Did you guys get firewood?
Yeah.
Did you go cut trees and collect it?
Well, I didn't.
No.
I didn't. We had people deliver them.
Okay.
No. In the house we had at 7th and Barnett, until we put in the basement with that iron fireman stoker, we heated the house with a big, what we called an old wooden coal range. Actually, we didn't burn any coal in it. All we burned was wood. And we had a man would deliver a whole load of black spruce logs. Of course, you know that black spruce log is like maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And they are very pitchy. They're very hot. But if they're dry, they make excellent firewood. And the logs would come out. We have a whole stack of them. And a man would come out with his Model T or whatever, and he'd jack the thing up on one side, and his rear wheel on one side had a belt drum on it. And he'd start the thing up, and of course, with it blocked up so it can't go anywhere, the engine ran the differential, and that wheel that was off the ground went like mad. And he had a belt on there that came up over another drum that drove the saw.
Huh.
And he had a bell saw, a round saw on it, cutoff saw. And it would make that turn it. And then he had a cradle that was hinged at the bottom and this way. And it would come down like this. He'd put one of those rounds of black spruce mm-hmm. on, push it forward, and that saw would go zap. And that log was cut round down here. Then my job was to get that out from under the saw, get it out of the way, and stack it in our woodshed. And I don't know, we burned, oh my goodness, we must have burned 6 or 7 cords
wow.
of those during the course of a winter.
Wow.
Then when we got the basement in there and put in an iron fireman and a hot air furnace that brought the air up to the rest of the rooms, my job was to stoke that fireman, take the clinkers out and all that, just basically tend the heating system. And of course we had to burn Healy River coal because of Cap.
Right, so that was going to say that iron fireman burned coal.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And that Healy River coal is dirty.
Right.
Lots of clinkers in it. And you know what a clinker is?
It's the leftover
conglomerate
stuff.
Well, because
right?
of all the crud and stuff in it, it solidifies into a kind of a almost like a brick.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that raises the dickens with the burner in the furnace. You got to take them out of there.
Okay.
And then I had to take them out every day.
Wow.
And one time, when I loaded the stoker, because it had a bin on it,
mm-hmm.
loaded it, I had to inspect all that coal. Because one time, there was a stick of dynamite in the coal.
Oh my goodness.
Well, it was one that didn't blow, because you know they had to drill and shoot.
Right.
It was one that didn't go off.
And it got thrown in with
oh,
the...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, good thing you found that.
Well, yeah, it is. It would have blown up for sure.
Oh, yeah. They would have gone the house.
Well, yeah, everything. And it was in the winter yet, too.
Oh. But so that using black spruce, you didn't have to split it. It was small enough to just use as a round?
Have you ever tried to split a piece of black spruce?
I can imagine. I know what the rings look like.
Well, that's the trouble. You know, you get a piece of black spruce about this long, and you try to split it, and you usually have about a 360-degree curl in it.
Right.
That's why they don't split.
Right.
You know, black spruce out in the woods, you never see them split because of frost. White spruce, you could, but black spruce, not ever. And, of course, they're pitchy as all get out.
Right. So that you had small enough ones that you could just
oh, yeah.
put
oh,
around
yeah.
in.
You know, about that, about 4 inches yeah. or 5 inches.
So how come you used black spruce and not white spruce?
Because the black spruce was available, and it has more heat than white spruce. And nobody was cutting white spruce that small in diameter.
Right.
So we used black spruce.
What about other people in town? Were they using...
I have no idea what they were doing. I wouldn't be surprised what they might be doing the same thing.
Well, because nowadays, we burn a lot of birch.
Birch is wonderful hardwood. It's good firewood. And we'd burn some of that. But birch, of course, a bigger piece of birch, that's too valuable to cut up for firewood.
What was it valuable for?
Well, if you wanted to make a bathhouse, it was made out of birch.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not sticky. You know, it doesn't have a lot of slivers in it.
Right.
But spruce does. Like Mrs. Simpainen's Finnish sauna that she had.
Mm-hmm.
Have I told you about that?
No.
Well, where Lacey Street hits Front Street, on the east side of Lacey and toward the river, because the river makes a little bend in there,
mm-hmm.
she had a Finnish sauna. And I'd never been in one before. And she had a son named Bill Simpainen, and Bill was a classmate of mine. So one day, Bill, in the middle of the winter, of course, when it's cold as the devil,
right.
he invited me to come and go to the sauna with him. Well, I didn't know what a sauna was. We went over there, took off all our clothes, took a cold shower, walked into the sauna, and it was a square room. We went in here, and this corner had a bunch of coals in it and a kind of a hood on it, and that's where the hot coals right. were, and a bucket of cold water with it, with a dipper in it. And over here was a bench.
Across from the
across from, and that bench was made out of birch.
Hmm.
And the paneling side of that room was all birch, solid birch planks. Well, you sit there on this bench or lay on the bench and you sweat like mad. And Mrs. Timpainen had a walkway in the backside on the other side of the wall, and she could lift up access to that stuff, and she'd put more coals in there to keep it cool. And every once in a while, Bill would take a dip of water and dump in that thing until that room was just like, well, it was almost like being in a steam boiler.
Yeah.
Well, that was fine and dandy, and you sweat like mad. And so we figured it's time for her to get up and go out and get dressed. You get up, and you walk out, and you got to walk through that cold shower. And that is a horrible shock.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get out without going through that shower. Then you get out and get dried off and get dressed again. And now you got to go outside. And it's 50 below zero outside.
Right.
That is an experience.
It is.
And I had to walk about the equivalent of maybe a whole block to get to the coffee shop so I could get in where there was a stove. Man. That was cold.
Yeah. Well, that's the tradition, is in some places you go out and go and roll in the snow.
The Finns can do that if they want to, but not me.
Not you.
Ed and I were just talking about that this morning. He said, if you do that, sweating it all out, then go roll in the snow. If you got any bugs, they're all dead.
That's right. You've frozen them off. Well, in the archives, there is that picture of your grandfather in the bakery and the coffee shop. And you were talking, so there was bread he made, and then he made pastries?
Yes, he did. Puff pastries. Well, you know what puff pastry
is?
Yes,
yes.
Okay. And it's flaky.
Right.
Okay, he made puff pastry, and we call those apple turnovers.
Right.
And, of course, it had apple filling. Now, apple filling was made out of dried apples because you couldn't get anything else.
Okay.
And so he made puff pastry, and then he made pies.
Okay.
And then he made his bread.
Okay.
And you saw the pictures there.
Right.
It looked as though it was maybe it raised in pans,
right.
I guess.
Because they were pan-shaped loaves.
Yeah. But he did not have a slicer.
Okay.
And so with those things, when they came out of them, dumped them out and cooled them, of course, and then put them out there for the display.
Did he make cookies?
Oh, yes, he made cookies.
Oh.
He made cookies. And then, of course, he'd bake a ham or something in there. And, you know, I don't remember ever having roast beef when I was growing up. Beef.
Well, you had
moose. Where are you going to get it?
Yeah.
Unless Kramer's or Bentley's slaughtered a cow.
Yeah.
Moose meat, that's different.
Right, but no beef.
And caribou, of course.
Right.
I like moose meat.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah.
I think you were lucky to have a grandfather who baked all those treats.
Yum, yum, you better believe it. You know, my grandpa told me one thing that stuck with me all my life. When my legs got me in trouble, when I came back from the hospital in 1938, before he died, he said, you know, they can take everything away from you, everything, no matter what you got. As long as you got your head, you're okay, because you can get it back.
Right.
If your head's gone, you don't care anymore anyway. And that stuck with me all my life. And here's a man that's in his 70s telling a kid who's maybe 14 years old something like that. It stuck with me.
Good.
And I'm glad it did.
Yeah.
Because some of the things I've done, they weren't very smart, but at least my head stayed with me.
That's right.
Yeah. So Well, I'm not complaining about a bit about the way I grew up.
Sounds like it was a good adventure.
Oh, of course it was. Living up here was an adventure.
Yeah.
And when we raised our kids up when we called the mountain, they did the same thing. They grew up there in innovative people.
Right.
And heaven knows what would have happened to them if we lived in the city.
Yep. Well, you say growing up here on the frontier, you had to make your own way.
Well, yeah. And you have to be able to adapt because everything changes, you know. And in the city, when everybody provides everything for you, well, you don't have a need to adapt.
Right.
And it's a different life.
Yep.
And it's a different outlook on life. And that's why in those days, those people, not like my grandfather and all the rest of us, you could put those people down almost anywhere in the world and they'd survive.
Right.
You take the same number of people out of Fairbanks right today and you put them out someplace and half of them will die.
Right.
They just really will.
Right.
Because they wouldn't know what to eat. They wouldn't know how to get anything to eat.
Well, that's everybody in the United States nowadays.
No, it's not.
We're very spoiled.
Well, up on the mountain, we hunted and we worked. We provided our own fuel
mm-hmm.
and our own water, everything.
That's very Alaskan.
No.
No.
In Washington.
I know, but that's a very Alaskan way to
live. Oh, of course.
But people who live in cities, they don't know.
No, people who live in the cities, when they depend on everything given to them, they're lost.
Yep.
And we used to see them in Wisconsin during the Depression. They'd come up there, the men would come up there to go hunting. Well, they're out there to shoot a deer. And when they get a deer, the only thing they wanted was the front feet.
Why?
They wanted them for a gun rack. You know, you take the front feet and taxiderm and put them up like this, and you can put your rifle across it. You're a big hunter now. About the head, the rest of the deer?
I thought they would take the head for the antlers.
Well, not often, because that's a problem, too. But what do you do with the carcass? Well, my father would guide some of these people, and we got the carcass. That was nice. Fresh meat.
Yeah, fresh meat.
And these dudes, you know, they paid to do that just to get those damn front legs.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And waste the rest of it? That's awful. And, of course, depression, if you get some fresh meat, you're going to grab it if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
And we kept chickens.
Okay.
In the Depression.
In Chicago or here?
No, in the Wisconsin during the Depression.
Okay.
Yeah, because during the Depression, we had to leave Chicago.
Oh, okay.
We just starved.
Right.
In 1935, before we came back up here, I worked for a produce market there on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago.
Hmm.
And we lived on Warren Avenue or Warren Street that intersected with Lincoln and about three or four blocks from Irving Park Boulevard. Al Seidel, another Germanic person, had this produce market. And, of course, it was all fresh produce, supposedly grown on his own farm mm-hmm. down in Illinois, southern Illinois. Well, he'd have nice, fresh tomatoes. He didn't grow a tomato in his life. They were shipped in paper mache things. And my job, behind the counter and out of sight, was taking them out of that thing, polishing them up, putting them up on the display case in the front. Now, Chicago at that time, even in the early 35, with a bunch of street urchins around, and I would have qualified as one, and there was a man came by with watermelons. Those watermelons were these great big long ones, mm-hmm. none of these little big ones. And us street urchins stand out there and we'd just be drooling. And he'd bring those watermelons in and was delivering them. And he'd deliver all these watermelons and he'd see us standing out there. And when he was all done delivering, somehow or another, he'd trip and he'd drop a watermelon. That thing lasted about 10 seconds. You get about five or six or so kids and grab a big piece of that watermelon and it was gone right now.
Yeah, that was nice of him.
Well, yeah, he knew, because there was no way my folks could have afforded a watermelon.
Right.
And who could have done that big anyway? There was also a seafood place in there.
A market
on that same mall. And I had been acquainted with crawdads, crawfish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think we have any crawdads up here at all.
No.
Too cold.
Yeah.
But I knew what crawdads were because in Wisconsin, I used them for fish bait. So I see this guy, and he's got a delivery. And they delivered Maine lobsters.
Whoa.
And he had a lobster that was about 12 or 14 inches long. And I figured that was the biggest crawdad I ever saw in my life. In those days, they didn't tape those front claws.
Oh.
Now they do, and good reason.
Right.
So I was paid 25 cents a week working for Al Sadell and a bag of produce every night that I could take home. And that was basically our meals.
Yeah.
Because my father wasn't getting very much money. So I paid that 25 cents to this market, and I got a lobster. A big, big lobster. And, of course, I picked it up by the shell, and I started walking home with this thing, and my sister Betty was with me, and I held it like this, and I kind of looking at that thing, and it got me.
Oh, no.
Right in my nose. I couldn't get him off my nose. I got home, and it hurt like mad.
Yeah.
And my mother got a big screwdriver, and she was able to get in there and pry his claw open to get me loose from him, and she put him in a bucket of water. My father came home from work that night, and he saw that thing in that bucket of water. He said, "Oh, boy, lobster." He put a pot of water on the stove, put that lobster in and cooked it, and he ate the whole damn thing, and I didn't get a bite.
Oh, no.
He ate the whole thing.
You should have at least gotten a claw.
I don't know. Oh, my goodness. Oh, gee.
Man.
I can tell you, I've had an interesting life.
Yes, definitely. A long, interesting life. Well, other Fairbanks memories that have come up while you've been here?
Well, one thing. When we drove down Cushman today, I looked where the old school was.
Mm-hmm.
It's now City Hall.
Right.
Okay. The old school just consisted of the Cushman Street side of that building,
right.
Really, because there was no gymnasium. And if you look at that building, on the left-hand side in front was a blank spot.
Mm-hmm.
That was our kind of a skating rink in there.
Okay.
And then the other side of the walkway was also a blank spot. And I would walk to school with my crutches after I got out of the hospital and have to take my crutch tips off before I'd go up the steps.
Right, yeah, you mentioned that yesterday.
Yeah. Now, when Ray Arjo came up, we got that gym on the backside, and then we'd have plays in that gymnasium because it was a stage-like thing on one side of it. And then we had P.E. in there every day. Mm-hmm. And that's when we had these basketball teams. And back behind that thing in the snow is where we dispose of the thermite and the...
Right. Well, you mentioned school plays.
Yes.
Were you in plays?
Yeah, two of them. I played the part of a cop in them. But just in two of them.
Okay. Because in high school you didn't play sports.
No, I couldn't.
Right.
And I was never much interested in sports anyway. In Chicago, I played backyard baseball with some. I got hit in the head with one. You know what a turnbuckle is?
I think so, but why don't you explain
it? Well, you know, if you got a threaded rod here. One is left-hand thread, the other is right-hand thread. And then you got a thing that has threads on each end, and you can turn it, and that pulls these rods together.
It's for tightening wires, right?
That's cables? The turnbuckle.
Right.
Well, we used to play baseball with one of them and the rod in only one end, and that turnbuckle was the thing you hit the ball with.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I got hit in the head with one of them
once. Oh, my. That sounds terribly dangerous.
Well, the kid that swung it wasn't very big.
Yeah, crazy. Okay. Well, and we didn't finish your military service. You ended up in England during the war.
Yes, I did. Oh, another thing to tell you. I told you when I came home on delay en route that Jim Hutchison wanted me to come over and see this young woman that...
Uh-huh.
Okay. And it turned out she became my wife when I got back from the war. Well, when I got to Boston, you know, I went through APO in Salt Lake City, and I figured I was going to the Pacific. I mean, after all, why go clear back across the country again? Right. But instead, they sent me to Boston. Okay, so when I get to Boston, I've got a pass so I can get in around the city and all. So I went in and had a big dinner and everything in Chicago, in Boston. And we boarded the ship. Now, the ship was the SS Mount Vernon. It had been the President Washington of the President Cruise Line. And the Navy was operating it. And I had 28 men on this side of the mess hall, and another sergeant had 28 on the other side. And our duty was KP.
Oh.
So I had my 28 men had one 12-hour shift to KP, and the other guy, his crew, had 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And the Navy serves Boston baked beans for Sunday dinner. It's tradition.
Mm.
I go up with my crew to have dinner, and who do I see in the mess hall who's basically the chief cook? Bill Simpainen.
No.
My, this is 45. Now I haven't seen him since 41 when I left Alaska and we're 10,000 miles away. And there he was.
That's funny.
Well, yeah. And I didn't have to do the KP. It was my underlings did the work, you know. Then Bill and I had quite a few talks on the way over to England.
Yeah.
And that ship went over all by itself. No escorts, no nothing, because it was pretty fast. And we had no problem at all. And I didn't get seasick.
Oh.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Went all around the top of Ireland. And when we started into the Irish Sea, between there and Scotland, that's when we had a submarine scare.
Oh.
Because there were depth charges going on all around us, and we docked in Liverpool.
And
then I went from there to the bases and so forth.
And what you were doing, airplane mechanic stuff?
I was the autopilot mechanic.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Bomb sight and autopilot mechanic.
Yeah. So it was the same work, you were just in England doing it.
Well, yeah. No, I didn't have to do any test flights in England because that maintenance was something else again.
Right.
And we had too much of a problem with some of the airplanes anyway. But down in Avon Park in Florida, yeah, that was different. And I had more risks in flying down there than I ever saw anywhere else.
Wow.
Because almost every test flight, some damn thing went wrong. And some of it was pretty nasty.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Well, the B-17 normally lands at about 90 miles an hour. We went out one time to go, and we do a meticulous pre-flight. Mm-hmm. Absolutely meticulous. Because some of the ground crew really weren't very ambitious. Or conscientious about what they were supposed to do. And I'm sitting in the airplane looking out one of the waist gunner positions, and the life raft, which was stowed above the radio room, flew out.
Uh-oh.
Well, that's supposed to be lashed down, so when it falls out, if you're going to need it, it automatically inflates.
Right.
Well, this darn thing didn't do that. It came out of there, and it wrapped around the horizontal stabilizer.
Ooh.
And was banging up and down on the stabilizer because it's got the CO2 bottles in there, banging up on the stabilizer. And of course, the pilot felt whatever happened, but he was able to get it off the ground. We went up in altitude about 5,000 feet or so, and we tried everything we could think of to get that damn thing off of there. Nothing worked. So I asked him, well, call the tower. Can we cut a hole in the fuselage so we can shove something out there and push it off the end of the stabilizer? So he called down to the base, and the commanding officer at the base said, no, you can't cut that hole in the fuselage. So now what are we going to do? So the flight engineer, he was a gutsy guy. He said, well, Harold, we've got an old radio antenna. And that was a real long whip antenna. He tied his combat knife to the end of that antenna, and he said, you hold my feet, and a couple of guys hold the waist door open. Luckily, this was on the right-hand side. And I'll go out, and I'll saw a hole on the top side of that thing so it will inflate with the airstream, and maybe that'll pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes out there, he's got his legs wrapped around me, and I'm holding him for dear life, and he doesn't have a chute on. No, he didn't have a chute on. And he got out there, and he's really out there, and if I let go, he's dead.
Right.
And he saws a hole in that stupid thing, and that wasn't easy either, because that's pretty tough fabric. And he inflated on the house on top side, and it quit banging, but it wouldn't come off.
Oh, God.
So we hauled him back inside again, shut the door. We called the tower and said, well, we can't get it off. And the pilot said, okay, I'll go up to about 10,000 feet. You guys all strap in and get your chutes on and everything, and I'll let you all bail out right over the top of Arbuckle Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And that way the crash boat will be out there and pick you all up. And we'll set this thing on autopilot, set it out over the Atlantic, and let it go crash. And most of us said, hey, I don't think I want to go down to Arbuckle Lake. I don't want to land in that lake. They've got big, scaly critters in there that would like to eat us. And they did, like 8-foot alligators.
Wow.
So he said, okay, I'll try to stall it. I'll do everything I can, side-slipping. No. Have you ever been in an airplane when you had to side-slip it?
I don't know what side-slipping is.
Well, ordinarily, when you're flying with a high-wing airplane, if you side-slip it, you tip it up and use your rudder to keep it sliding, and you slide down.
Mm.
And you do that to lose altitude quickly, and even at speed. Well, you don't really want to side-slip a low-wing airplane, because if you do, this fuselage blanks out the airflow over the upper wing.
Oh,
so you'll go this way and then this way.
Oh.
So I'll try anything. And he did. He got up there, he did everything he could and couldn't get it off. He said, I can't get it off. What do you want to do? Want to take a chance? Okay, we'll try. And we tried to find out what airspeed that airplane would go out of control. So he got up there around 10, 12,000 feet. And he tried to see just how slow he could go with that thing before he couldn't control it. Well, it was about 115 miles an hour, 25 miles more than normal landing speed.
Mm-hmm.
We only got about a 5,000-foot strip. So he says, okay, I'm going to try. So we came down at 115 miles an hour, touched down right at the end of the runway, and as soon as we touched down, on went the brakes. And we got to the other end, just to the other end, and that stupid raft came off at about 50 miles an hour.
Wow.
It came off. and there were holes and dents in that horizontal stabilizer. We got back to the with that airplane, and the base maintenance manager, who was a light colonel, he started looking for the guy that signed off on the 1A form who stowed that life raft. And I don't know whatever happened to him, but if they hung him up by his you-know-what, that wouldn't have bothered me a bit. But we had that kind of thing happen all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost every flight something's going wrong. So I'm telling you, I could have been shot at and I wouldn't have been any more dangerous.
Right, yeah. No, I think probably better.
You would have more than likely.
You've been on the ground at least.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but yeah. That happened all the time. All the time.
Well, you guys were brave.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I was adaptable. Now, we have still Zapel living in Germany.
Oh, okay.
I never contacted them. Ever. The reason I did not want to endanger my top secret clearances. You see, the work I was doing at Boeing was top secret and even beyond. I did not want to contact anybody for fear of losing my clearance.
Right.
See?
Do you still have relatives in Alaska?
Well, I've got my nephew, Walter Harkness, that lives here.
Okay.
And his wife, George Harkness, lives down at Anchorage. And Kathy Andrews, their sister, lives in Anchorage. And their kids. And frankly, I don't know where all their kids are.
Right.
But that's the only ones we have.
Yeah.
That I know of.
Right.
We may have others, but I don't know them.
And those are your sister's children.
Well, those Betty's kids.
Right.
Because Perry and Heather, they went down to the States.
Okay.
So, and that's all that's here.
Okay.
Yeah, with nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, I wanted to come back.
Yeah.
I really did.
I can tell it's meant a lot to you.
Well, it did. And it still does.
Yeah.
It still does. But physically, I don't think I could cope with it anymore.
Right.
You know, with this thing here kind of puts a limit on you.
Yeah, that wheelchair does. And Fairbanks has changed a lot.
Well, I wouldn't live in Fairbanks. Not at all.
Yeah.
I was thinking I might go out at Big Delta and live out there. But when you have the problems that I have, they're not great, but they're problem.
Right.
And with the canes and this wheelchair, I need to be living with somebody who could kind of look after me a bit. So, I think I could still cook. So but
why do you say you would not live in Fairbanks?
I would not live in a big city.
Okay.
And this is a big city. It has all of the amenities and all of the problems. And I'm sure you have problems with, I won't say homeless, but drunks and drugs too now in the street. And we never had any problem.
Right.
When I was growing up, I never heard of anybody getting mugged in Fairbanks. We had drunks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one drunk. He had a house out on, I think it must have been about on 6th by Cushman,
mm-hmm.
and it had a big snowbank. And he went into town one day and got absolutely snockered. I mean, he was just drunk as could be. And he went home. He couldn't get in his house. He crawled into that stupid snowbank.
Oh, no.
Into the snowbank, and that's where he went to sleep. And somebody came by and saw him. Saw his feet sticking out. They hauled him out of the snowbank, and he lived.
Wow.
So we had a little bit of that sort of thing, but that's all. But it wasn't really a problem. Wasn't a problem. Now it is a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I could survive in Fairbanks anymore. It's still better. Maybe it's a desire to live back in the frontier again. It's maybe up here.
Yeah.
It's certainly not here anymore.
Well, the world has changed.
Well, it changed.
Every place, yes.
The war changed everything, and even after that, it continued to change.
And in Alaska, the pipeline changed everything.
Well, I think
again.
It changed. Yeah, I think it changed a lot before the pipeline.
Well, I know, but the war and then
oh, yeah.
becoming a state and then the pipeline.
Well, the war was the beginning.
Right.
Because with all that influx of all those military people, you know, there really wasn't any military installation up here at all.
No.
None.
Right.
Now there's Army posts and Air Force posts all over the place.
Right.
And you've got also the place down along the Denali Highway, Cold something or other. There's a military...
Oh, in...
That's a geophysical place, I think.
Well, and there's the HAARP research station. There's CLEAR Air Base.
Yeah, okay.
Near Nenana in Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's stuff all over now.
Yeah.
Well, but there used to be more. There used to be the White Alice sites.
Oh, yeah.
And the Dew Line. And we had Nike missile sites.
My brother, Art, worked at the Dew Line. He installed those radar things up there. All over the
wow.
Dew Line.
Yeah.
Because he worked for Bell Telephone.
Okay.
My wife worked for Bell Telephone back in 1946.
Wow.
She was just, well, before that even. When she was 16, they hired her as a telephone operator in Ephrata.
Yeah.
And she was the first one of the high school kids that Bell Telephone did that because they couldn't get women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the grown women had families and stuff. They didn't want to work telephone operating at night.
Right.
So the high school kids could do that. And Betty was the first one that they hired like that. So mm-hmm. she worked for Bell way back when it was Bell.
Yeah.
And when my brother Art left the Navy, got out of the Navy, then he went to work for them as well. And her brother were putting these high towers in.
Oh.
Until one of his friends fell off of one of the towers, and he said he was not going to do it anymore. He wouldn't go up anymore.
Yeah.
So,
that was smart.
So we were associated with it.
Yeah.
But that was a whole different thing. My brother Art, he was pretty smart. He really was. And when you change electronic equipment, you have to be very careful because here you take out a rack that's all hooked up with everything and you have to replace it with the newer equipment. And on the Dew Line, the lines would come in and go through these stations, you know, serving stations, mm-hmm. servers really. And when they came in with new equipment, when you tried to change these old ones out and put new ones in, you had to do this thing without losing one of your lines. So in Seattle, where they had a lot of these had to be replaced, they brought him in. He was back at East someplace at the time to do this. And he and his friend, because he had a helper, went in and he told the manager the thing, "Now, you just go away, shut the door, and let us sit in here and think." So Art and his friend sat there and looked at these and looked at all the things. And he told the manager, "You give me a bottle of scotch and a piece of paper, and I'll figure out a way to do this." So he did. Then they got the new equipment in, and he went and he did something. And they changed every one of those servers without losing a single line
wow.
of the Dew Line. When he was done, the manager said, hey, I want to know how you did that. Art said, go to hell. This I figured out on my own, and I'm not going to tell you. And he didn't. They wanted him to go back to Western Electric Labs, mm-hmm. and he refused. Because if he went back there, anything he came up with, the lab would have grabbed. So he worked with them until he finally got disabled, and then
right.
that was the end of that. But he never gave them anything.
No. Nope.
And all the things that I invented at Boeing, Boeing got.
Right.
And I've got 3 patents, but Boeing's co-owner on every one of them.
Right, because they were paying you.
Well, I was being paid and
right.
come up with these different things. So
So what do you have patents on?
Well, I've got patents on a leading edge flap. I've got patents on what we called a pure bending machine. Because it's really hard to have a machine that can put pure bending, because usually whenever you're doing anything like that, you've got shear and you've got tension or compression. It's hard to get pure bending. And some of the testing that we were doing, you wanted to have pure bending. So I wound up with devised a device that would work that way, and we patented it. And we patented another, I can't remember the next one, but it was one of these things, testing type equipment.
Right. Cool.
But I never made a dime from any of them, but anyway, I had them.
But Boeing paid you.
Well.
You had a pretty good salary from Boeing,
probably. Oh, yes,
probably.
Of course.
Yeah.
When I retired, I think my salary was like $65,000 a year in 1990, and that's a good salary.
Yeah.
Plus vacation and stock.
Oh.
So it was a good thing.
Good job. It was a good career.
Well, it was.
Yeah.
I wanted to leave it. I wanted to come up here.
Right.
But the wife wouldn't, and so it's just as well. Because right now I'm living on my Social Security and some of the investments I've got.
Right.
And save my pension. I got right now in retirement, my income is about $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
That's
a damn good retirement.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I certainly don't eat that much anymore.
No. Well, it sounds like you've had a great life.
Well, I've had a good life. I wouldn't argue about it. There were problems. I'd rather have the use of my legs again.
Right.
But, hey, I've survived.
Right. Great.
And as long as my head is here, I'm fine.
Yeah, that was your grandfather's good advice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, take everything else they want, but if they don't take your head, you're still okay.
Right.
And I suppose that if the circumstances was right, I could probably go back, maybe teach or something, because I'm sure there's a lot of things I could teach some of these young people.
I'm sure.
With math and so on.
Yeah.
Because I took every math course that was available.
Well, and all the engineering and
intuition
stuff. Yep.
Well, you know, I don't think today that a high school graduate really knows how to think. I really don't think they do. Because they do everything by rote now.
Right.
And if there's anything that's wrong, is anybody that has to be an engineer or an innovator doing it by rote, that's the worst thing you can do. That's absolutely the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And even if somebody specializes in math and engineering, what does he know about history?
Right.
I read everything.
Right.
History, everything. Because in Alaska, everybody reads books.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to do when it's 60 below zero and you can't go outside? Well, you read.
Right. Nowadays, people watch television or things. But when you were growing up, you read.
Well, we didn't have television.
Right.
Matter of fact, we didn't have radio either.
Oh, okay.
Not up here.
Oh.
What you did have was so sketchy you couldn't hear it anyway.
Right.
You had KFAR, but that was all. And so you read.
Yeah.
You read. And when I was in St. Joseph's Hospital.
You read a lot.
I read every book that was in the church library. Every last one of them. I'd read 9 books a day.
Wow.
All day. Well, what could I do?
You must be a fast reader.
Well, I was then. Yeah, no kidding. You know, you're sitting on your back, light, and bored out of your skull if you don't do something.
Right.
So I read everything. And some of the books were historical. And in our house in Washington, where we call it the mountain,
right.
I had a bookcase on one of the halls, and a bookcase in my little office I had, And in that Hall bookcase, we had, and we still have them. Are you acquainted with the old Time Life books?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole bunch of them.
Wow.
Those are heirlooms.
Yeah.
I've got Reader's Digest. You remember the condensed books from Reader's Digest?
I remember Reader's Digest, the magazine, but I don't know the books.
They put out a whole bunch of books, and they basically were the stories from Reader's Digest condensed into these books. We've got probably 40 or 50 of them in that library, in the Time Life books,
mm-hmm.
and other, Life?
Mm-hmm.
Life, I think. We've got a bunch of them. Those are heirlooms. Those are right. Books that are out of print.
When you were growing up here, the house you grew up in, were there books in that house?
In our house?
Yeah. Did you have a library? Shelves of books?
Well, I went to the library here.
Oh, there was a library.
Yeah, there was a library. And I read whatever I could get. It wasn't a very big library, but I read everything.
But I was wondering if at home, did your parents keep books and did they read?
Surprisingly enough, no.
Hmm.
My father and my mother were too busy just trying to keep body and soul together, you might say.
Right.
And so they didn't do much reading, but I read everything I could get.
What about your grandparents?
Well, Grandpa was too busy to read, and Grandma, of course, was only here just a few short months before she died.
Right.
So she didn't read much, although she could read, because she was very well educated. You know, my father only went through eighth grade.
Oh, okay.
But my mother essentially graduated from high school back when high school was much more rigorous than today.
Mm-hmm.
But the life is different here.
Right. But your parents emphasized education?
They didn't do it, but Grandpa certainly did.
Okay.
He emphasized it.
Because you wanted to go to college.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Where that came from, it was probably Grandpa.
Yeah, other than the fact that also I was well prepared to go, because reading all the things I read and tried all the different things, I was all ready to go to college.
Right.
See, so I really credit the environment here where I grew up. It really made a difference.
Yeah.
But in the city, if we'd stayed in the city, I probably would have gone to jail. Well, I'm serious.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to do?
Well, you could have taken over your grandfather's business.
Well, if I was here, I could have. In Chicago, not a chance.
No.
Not a chance. In Chicago, I may very well have been associated with Al Capone because of the liquor.
Yeah, or your parents' bar or hotel.
Oh, yeah.
But you didn't want to go into the family business.
Well, I wasn't interested in that anyway. I didn't drink when I was a kid. I drank in the Army some. And after some of those test flights, we were damn glad to be able to drink.
Right.
But, you know, other than that, why, no.
Yeah.
And my business flights back and forth, because every year, for probably 30 years at Boeing, I made at least 4 or 5 business flights every year. For technical conferences mm-hmm. and things like that, and technical papers to present, or to the Pentagon and so on, and different military bases. And we flew business class or first class,
no.
If we could get a seat. And yeah, sure. Yeah, I drank until one day I came home, and the wife met me with a car and the kids in it, and I had had a drink on the way home. And she opened all the windows to come down, and I didn't drink any more. Not more. That was enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to smoke.
Oh.
I smoked a pipe, not cigarettes and not cigars. But I said, hey, I don't want to smoke anymore. And I'll tell you something. I put that tobacco in my pipe, on my pipe stand, right where I sat down to read the paper. And it sat there for 2 years. I figured, I want that temptation sitting right there. And if I can beat it, I'll beat it.
Good for you.
That was in 1962.
Wow.
60 years ago is when I quit smoking.
That's good. That's a hard thing to do with it sitting right there next to you.
That's right. Because if the temptation is there and you can whip it, you've got it beat.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
If you can't, you're through.
Well, I was wondering if you've sort of said that your father liked to drink. And if that affected your decision to not drink.
That's right. That's right. I drank some in the Army, but
right.
not like he did.
Right.
He could go through $3,000 of booze in 1 year back in the 50s.
Wow.
And that's a lot of booze.
Yeah.
A lot of booze. And, of course, I now know that I've got a number of half-brothers or sisters all over the place.
Because of that.
Yeah, because of his behavior.
Hmm.
My mother left him, you know, for 1 year.
Oh.
Because of that. But, well, that was him.
Right.
That was him.
Right. But so he had an influence on you, too.
Oh, of course he did.
Yeah.
Of course he did. I remember down at Avon Park working, you know, in the B-17, and we got a package for Christmas. It was a bottle of scotch and a bottle of rye and a bottle of bourbon. That how in the world he got that through the mail system, I don't know. But I got it down there. And, of course, I was not about to drink all of that.
Right.
So our whole crew wound up finishing that off. It came through the mail.
Well, maybe then it was okay to mail. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think it was legal.
Yeah. It's not now, but maybe then.
No, I don't know.
Anyway.
Well, anyway.
other Fairbanks things, or should we take a lunch break? Are you hungry?
Oh, there used to be a Ford garage on Cushman Street, and I think it was about between 5th and 6th. And, of course, remember, Cushman Street was all gravel.
Right.
And in the summertime, you got a lot of dust.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd take all of his waste oil from changing the oil in the cars, and he'd go out and he'd sprinkle Cushman Street in front of the store to oil it down to keep the dust down.
Ugh.
You can't do that anymore.
No.
But he had the only clean street in town.
Sounds like a mess, if you ask me.
Oh, there used to be a man that lived out on Badger Road, and he grew strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd bring them into town. Now, Badger Road is all houses and stuff now.
Right.
But then it was farm.
Yeah, well, all of what is now North Pole probably wasn't there.
No, it really wasn't. It really wasn't. And let's see. Well, oh, I know I forgot to tell you. Bill Gillum.
Ah.
Bill Gillum flew Fairchild Pilgrims.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a funny-looking airplane. They had a deep belly on them. And he used to fly them up to Barrow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one day or 1 year up there, there was a sow polar bear got into the garbage disposal up there, and she had three little cubs, and she became a real menace, so they had to kill her. Now, here are these three cubs, and they're only about that big, cuddly little white things.
Little babies, yeah.
Little babies. What are you going to do? You're going to kill those cubs? So Gillum said, well, hey, I'll take them back to Fairbanks. So he did, He brought all three of them back, and on the side of his hangar, he built an enclosure, and he used heavy chicken wire as the enclosure. And here's these three little cubs in there, and of course, they don't stay cubs very long.
No.
So they're very, very fast growing. Mm-hmm. And we used to go out and see those little buggers. They were just as cute as a bug's ear. I mean, just really pretty,
yeah.
Except that they're getting pretty big. And, of course, Fairbanks Gardens was up there, and Fairbanks Garden grew cabbages.
Oh.
And so those cabbages are there, and those bears got the wind of all those cabbages, and, of course, that's like ice cream to them. And they went right out through that chicken wire cage and got into the cabbage patch. And so here they are, they're gobbling down cabbages like crazy. So they called out all the young men and men in town that were available to try and herd those bears back. Well, you don't herd polar bear cubs.
No.
Not when they're that big, you know.
What, they're 3 feet tall already?
Well, we tried to herd them, mm-hmm. and then they turned toward one of the guys, and of course he'd back out of the way again. Till they finally got a couple of people in there who were ex-cowboys with lariats, and they roped those bears, and they got them back into Gillum's cage, and he put welded wire mesh on that thing so it was harder to break, and he took them outside. One of them went to the Smithsonian Zoo or Institute. One of them went to the Chicago Zoo Institute, and I'm not sure where the other one went, but it went to one of them someplace. Mm-hmm. So those bears lived out their lives in a zoo someplace.
Well, that's probably better.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do?
Right.
Because even if you were able to take them out in the woods here someplace and turn them loose, they would have been a danger. Either a black bear would have got them, or they'd have got a black bear, or they might have interbred with them. Then you got a real mess.
They do interbreed with grizzlies sometimes.
I know they do.
But those little cubs wouldn't have known how to survive in the wild, probably.
Well, they probably would have been at the landfill, and they might have been one of those ones that Pop Wiener would have seen.
Yeah.
But, it would have been hard because they didn't have a mother to teach them.
Right. So where was this Fairbanks Garden?
Well, okay. Go out Cushman to about 16th or past Weeks Field.
Okay.
And that was the garden started right in there.
Okay.
And, of course, Gillum's hangar wasn't that far away from it.
So Gillum's hangar was on Weeks Field.
Yeah, I know. Okay. It was on the far side of Weeks Field.
Okay.
Oh, on the east end of Weeks Field.
Okay.
There was a hangar over there, and that's where they had an old Fokker trimotor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of, I think, Roald Amundsen was trying to fly over the pole with him. And he had a couple of them, and that one, they couldn't get it started or couldn't work it. And it was there. And I used to go out to that hangar and play around on that thing. It had three big Jumo engines in it, the German engines. And Ford, when he made the Ford trimotors, he did not have aerodynamic engineers, so he got one of those things and he used copper tubing and laid out the wing and used the copper tubing to get the wing foil because he didn't have anybody to tell him. So he made the wing foil and he copied that airplane, or not that one, but another one. He copied it, except that he made his airplane out of corrugated aluminum. And the Fokker one was smooth.
Mm.
See? But that's what Henry Ford did. Of course, he was innovative, and so he did that.
Right.
See? And anyway, we played on it, and I've no idea whatever happened to that thing. Of course, there's houses up there now.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it would not really have been an heirloom or anything like that, no. so scrapped it out.
Howard Hughes came through Fairbanks, but that was later.
Well, it was there in 1935.
No, Howard Hughes. He came
I didn't know that Howard Hughes ever came here. I know that Wiley Post and Will Rogers came here.
That was before you, though.
Yeah, but they landed right there on the river.
Right.
And then they got killed up there at Barrow.
Right. That was... Any other famous people came through while you were growing up? You remember?
Yeah, there was one. I wouldn't say famous, but I think he was one of the Turtlings or something was up here, and he'd gotten sick, and he was in the hospital at the same time I was.
Mm.
But that's the only person of any note that I remember.
Well, then the pictures in the archives from your mother have those pictures of Leonard Sepulveda.
Leonard Sepulveda.
Yeah.
Okay. I have an identical one of that Leonard Sepulveda gave my mother. And Leonard Sepulveda was here, of course.
Right.
And he knew my mother. But when I got here, I don't think Leonard was here anymore.
Okay.
See, so I never knew him.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother certainly knew him.
Yeah.
See, so she knew everybody. Everybody that was in town.
Right.
You know, 4,000 or 5,000 people. You know them all.
Right. Well, and that's why she had that photo of him, that she knew him.
Oh, yeah. And she knew him.
And he was here for dog racing.
Well.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, this town was a very compact thing. And you knew everybody. And you knew all their ills and all their goods, too.
Right.
And some people you wanted to associate with and some you didn't. And it was a pretty nice place.
Right.
If I could live in a city like that or a town like that today, I would if I could.
Right.
But I don't know of any places like that anymore.
Well, maybe a small town someplace.
Well, yeah, but now with the drug business, you even got the drugs in a small town.
Yeah.
Where I do live with Becky, that's my son, middle son's widow, and her second husband, they've got 10 acres, and we're outside of the town of Cle Elum.
Mm-hmm.
And Cle Elum is an old mining town. And there's Cle Elum was mining, and Black Diamond was mining, and Roslyn was coal mining, and Ronald was coal mining. And in that area, Ronald was the colored town, colored miners, and Roslyn was the white miners, and Cle Elum apparently serviced all those mines. And it's a small town. It really is. And some of the small town amenities, good things are there. But from a standpoint of a hospital, it doesn't have one.
Right.
If you want to go to the hospital, you got to go to the town of Ellensburg. And that's 25 miles away. And for me, that's fine for me, because I'm ridiculously healthy except for my illness thing.
Right.
But that's why I couldn't stay on the mountain in
right.
Hobart anymore. Because the medics wouldn't let me go home.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. They want you to be safe.
Well, the problem is that where we lived on the mountain, you had to go through a locked gate,
mm-hmm.
that's through the Cedar River watershed, go up this mile, and then follow the road in, finally up on the hill, and you're fine. When my wife's parents lived up there with us, Tom had a heart attack. We called the medics, and they came through and got him, took him back, and took him down to the hospital. And he ultimately died. When I got sick, and they had to take me out, Holly was there, and she had to go down 3 miles down to the intersection where the fire station was and escort that medic up. They wouldn't come up with the ambulance.
Wow.
Well, that was 2014.
Yeah.
They simply wouldn't come up. And I can understand that, because that could have been a scam call to get the medics up there, and then somebody would hijack them for the drugs or whatever they had in the place. The world, the environment's changed.
Right.
So they would not come up. Then they got me and took me back down to the hospital for treatment. And when they let me out of the hospital, the medic said, "You can't go back up on that mountain." Because if you do and something happens and there's not somebody here to come down and get us,
we can't
who's
going to
come up and get you?
Yeah.
See? So that's why we moved over to Cle Elum. We moved to Yakima and then come out Cle Elum. So there's good points about being isolated like that.
Right.
And there's some bad ones when you get old or you get sick or something like
right.
that. But it is a much better environment to live out like that than in some big city like this one.
Yeah.
And this is a big city. Ed checked it today. It says you got 50,000 people in here.
Well, that's just, I think, in the city limits.
I know.
There's more. I think it's more like eight.
You've got North Pole and you've got the bases. And I don't think they count the bases.
No, and you have the borough, which is bigger than the city. I think it's more than that.
The borough goes way out there.
Yeah.
So just within the city, 50,000 people.
Yeah.
And that's a big city as far as I'm concerned. 50,000, good grief. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing compared with Seattle.
No, I was going to say, compared to other places, it's small, but I agree, it's a city. Yeah.
Well, all of the problems that Seattle's got, you got them here too.
Yep, we do. We do.
And that's unfortunate, because this was a very nice place to live.
Mm-hmm.
Hard in the wintertime, but I'm not complaining either,
no,
I'll tell you.
It sounds like you had a really good time growing up here.
I think so. I really think so, until I hurt my legs
right.
and all. But, right. hey, that could have happened anywhere.
And formed some really good friendships with people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This was a good place.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your memories of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So.
And she wanted to come home, and she did. And she lived finally in the Golden Towers.
Your mom.
Yeah.
Yep.
And she went to the post office, you know, sent the federal
Downtown.
Building
right.
to get her mail, and she had a heart attack on the front steps.
Yeah.
And then they put her in Memorial Hospital, and then we all came up to say goodbye. But she had a good life
she
here.
She had a good life, too.
Yeah. And if she hadn't gone into Golden Towers, I was going to get her back down to us, for us.
How old was she when she died?
How old was she?
Yeah.
Well, she was born in 1904. She died in 78. So she was 74.
Oh, so she was young. Comparatively.
Well, 74. Yeah, well, she was old compared with the normal lifespan.
Yeah.
You know, in 78, so she was 74. And I was 55.
Yeah.
But, well, Grandpa, he lived into his 70s.
Yeah.
Grandma lived into her 70s about. No, my father didn't, of course,
right.
but that was rheumatic fever. But Elsie, his sister, she lived into her 90s. And she was a Harridan. She was redheaded. She was a party girl.
Hmm.
And I guess she got her red hair from our Viking ancestors or something like that. But she was red. And by the way, Betty had red hair just like yours.
Oh.
Same color.
Your wife or your sister?
No, my sister.
Oh, okay.
My wife was blonde.
Okay.
And, of course, she came from Bisbee, Arizona.
Right.
And she absolutely wouldn't even come up on a visit.
Yeah, that's too bad.
It is, really.
Yeah, to at least see where you'd grown up.
Well, if she had been able to live up here for a year, back when it was still a decent place to live for a young person, she may have liked it. But she couldn't.
Right.
She just couldn't. Wouldn't even come.
Yep.
Ed is still looking around. You know, he's 61, and one of these days he'll retire, and he has lots of projects up here.
Right.
All these hydroelectric things and river control. And I think he'd like to come up here, but not into the city.
Right.
We're going to look around at Hope.
Oh.
Because there may be a place there in some place out like Palmer or Wasilla.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to spend the night down at Hope or down at Homer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to spend the night at Wasilla. We've been there before, but we're
right.
going to look around. But that's not bad.
Right.
And the weather's not that bad.
Right.
Not down there.
Well, the weather has gotten better here because of climate change. It doesn't get as cold. It's still dark, but not so cold.
Well, yeah, not so cold. And, of course, that climate change can change the other way just as easily. Because I think if you look at the solar extremes, we're just about to turn the corner away from a hot climate to a cold one, because it, you know, cyclical. People's memories are short.
Yes.
Our lifetime is short. And so in nature, nothing is stable. Nothing is stable in nature. It goes up and down, prey and predator, climate's the same way. And one of these days you're gonna get into a glaciation phase again. And then these glaciers are going to come back. Now, you won't have glaciers here, but I'm sure that the Black Rapids Glacier will be back. You know, it almost ran down and cut off the highway.
Yeah, I know. A long time ago.
Not so long ago. I was here when it did that the first time.
Well, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, and then the Worthington Glacier up on Thompson Pass.
Yeah.
It's going to cut off the road one of these days. So... It's cyclical. And the Mendenhall Glacier down in Juneau, it's going to come down all the way to the sea. And that won't be so far along. I remember when the Mendenhall Glacier was right close to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
So it happens. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, enjoy the sunshine.
Yes. Yes.
Because one of these days it won't be here.
That's right. Well, Ed, thank you so much for all your time and your memories.
Well,
and it's just
I enjoy
great.
Talking with you. And I wanted to get this done.
Right.
Because I won't be coming back.
Right. Well, it goes very well with the photographs.
Oh, absolutely.
That we have in the collection. So thank
you.
Yeah,
absolutely. And when I get into mine, I will put captions on each one of them.
Great.
And send them up, copies of them up here for you.
That's great.
Because there's some in there that I know you don't have.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, especially the stuff that I had from 49. Because...
That was for the highway?
Yeah, when I worked on the Taylor Highway. There's places on the Richardson that were really something else again in 49.
Mm.
That, and even in 49.
Yeah.
There were some potholes out there. You could bury a car.
I'm sure.
Just it's awful.
Not a great road.
Well, yeah. It was the only road, so you needed to do what you could.
Right.
The washboard. You know, the Richardson used to have big swells in the spring. Because of permafrost thaw and
yeah, the frost heaves.
Well, of course, you know, I mean, these were big. Some of them were like a couple of feet high. So in the spring, they'd come through with their road patrol, and they'd cut those tops off and put them in the holes, you know, in the tips, to flatten out the road. Well, that's fine. But next spring, you got to do it all over again.
Right.
And right now, I do believe that some of that Alcan has got exactly the same problem.
Oh, yeah.
And the Richardson, too, in places.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when they built the Alcan, they just built it, and they didn't care. They just needed to get something in here.
Right.
And so they went right out across the Muskeg and built a road. As long as it was frozen, it was great.
Right.
But springtime, it was altogether different. And there are, I know there's places on there that are really sinkholes.
Yeah.
Really sinkholes.
Yeah, they just keep doing road maintenance and trying new things.
Yeah, but now you've got airplanes and you can do almost everything with an airplane. You don't care.
Well, in state, we still, you know, to go to Valdez on the Richardson Highway, it's easier to drive than to fly.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, Anchorage, we can fly.
I don't think I'd want to fly down to Valdez.
No.
Where would you land?
Well, they do have an airstrip.
I know, but you know, those mountains all around
it. I know. I wouldn't want to fly there either. But okay, well, why don't we take a break and
yeah,
finish for now.
And then we go look at those pictures.
Yep.